Thank you, Rosemary, and it's such a wonderful experience to be here with all of you and to see you sharing with each other your life and the joys and sorrows of life during this time of the pandemic. I know it's not easy for any of us, but it's kind of amazing that this technology allows us to see and hear each other. Mm-hmm. You know, not quite what it is like to be in person, of course, but still really powerful. So thank you all for having me today. I'll share my screen here for a few minutes and we'll have a little conversation about what my organization's about and kind of what I've been doing, but also some emerging vision for the future a bit. So Paths to Understanding was a kind of a merger between Neighbors in Faith, which was the organization I founded to counteract anti-Muslim bigotry, and then the Tracy Levine Center, which was also called Camp Brotherhood, a little bit further in the past. As you know, Camp Brotherhood was sold in 2016, and all of that begun by Rabbi Raphael Levine of Temple to Hersh Sinai and Father William Tracy, who still lives out at Camp Cory, who the camp was sold to. I was out to visit him about a month ago, and he is still reading and walking and thinking and changing every day. A beautiful vision for our lives. So I just appreciate his intellectual and emotional curiosity and willingness to continue to grow. So we renamed it Paths to Understanding because people were often confused at who Tracy Levine was. They thought it was some kind of young woman or something. So they really didn't know what it was about. So we came up with Paths to Understanding. And of course, the word path is a really important word in many traditions about the way or the walk, or in Judaism, it's the halakha, the way. In Islam, it's the Sharia. There's many other, there's the third way of Buddhism, right? But then we also got to leaning into this word understanding, that we believe that every wisdom tradition is a path to understanding. And understanding includes three things. It includes comprehension. It also includes compassion, like I understand you. And then it also can mean a cooperative relationship where we have an understanding to do something together. And that sort of matches up pretty well with our mission, which is we want to, in our strategy, we want to tell inspiring stories. And we're in a time of incredible negativity where it only reads if it bleeds. But there's so many powerful, wonderful things going on. Even in Western Washington State, I can go up and down I-5 and talk about all the incredible people doing really remarkable work with each other. We also want to nurture relationships between people of different wisdom traditions and communities of wisdom. And we use those terms because a lot of times we use the term like faith community or congregation. But especially the word faith community is kind of a Christianish word. The word faith is used in a particular way by Christians. And so we thought, you know, carefully about how to refer to communities, and we decided to call them communities of wisdom. And traditions, communities of faith. So we want to nurture relationships between communities of wisdom. And we also want to encourage folk to act together for the common good. So part of a vision that's beginning to emerge for us is that, and this is a bit small on the screen, I suspect, but in 1990, there wasn't a ton of religious and racial and cultural diversity in the Puget Sound region in the Salish Sea. But by 2016, that had really increased. And not only had it increased, it had expanded throughout the region. So for a time, much of the cultural diversity and racial diversity in around the Salish Sea was pretty concentrated. And now it's like going everywhere. And it's been estimated by the Puget Sound Regional Council that about 1.9 million people will move into Western Washington in the next 30 years. And probably with climate change, And Western Washington being among the places that are going to be not quite as impacted, I think that number is going to be much higher. And if you think about many of the communities like Mount Vernon, for instance, and Burlington, Snohomish, but also some suburban kind of communities that had seen themselves as predominantly white and Christian to some degree, now there's going to be a lot of diversity, including racial and religious diversity, cultural diversity moving in. And the real question is, how are we going to welcome and understand and recognize the strengths and the contributions of our new neighbors? And so part of what we're starting to think about now is, how can we identify some of those communities that maybe perceive themselves to be kind of monocultural? And how can we help communities of wisdom begin to reach out to the current diversity around them and begin to prepare themselves with partnerships and fun and also, actions for the common good, so that they can welcome their new neighbors who are on their way? So one of the ways that we're doing this work is talking about authentic allyship. And we were encouraging congregations that want to be in partnership with others, that want that are open to cultural and religious and racial diversity, but sometimes sort of remain passive and a bit disconnected from neighbors that are sometimes oppressed by the larger dominant culture, and so they're willing. They kind of want to stand with folk, but they don't always know how. And in that conversation with communities of color, many of them asked us if we would be willing to put together an allyship course, because sometimes people come in with the best of intentions, but don't always behave and act in ways that are really ultimately helpful. And so we came up with this course starting about a year and a half ago called The Practice of Authentic Allyship. And part of why it's needed, of course, is because we have 500 years of racism and religionism and other kinds of status-keeping systems at play. And so part of what we try to help people understand is that, as Ibram X. Kendi has helped us to see, is that racial divisions, cultural kinds of superiority really begin not with individuals who have ignorance and hate, but really it begins with a few powerful people who want to expand their economic, political, and cultural self-interests. And they then begin to create racially discriminatory policies that are sort of baked into the cake of the policies and laws of a land, sometimes even the national narratives that are told. These then get sold through racist ideas that are marketed to the population, which then all of which together creates ignorance and hate and divisions between people who are all being negatively impacted by some of these racially discriminatory policies. And so we want to help people understand that we've all been swimming in a soup of racism for 500 years, and all of that is creating an ongoing cycle where all of those four pieces begin to support each other and to make things worse. We also try to remind people that racism is not simply bias. We all have intrapersonal sort of racist ideas and attitudes in us, perhaps. I know I do. We also can see racism expressed intrapersonally. And a lot of times in the conversation that we have nationally, and then in news media especially, and by politicians, interpersonal racism is the only thing they want to talk about. But we also know it gets expressed institutionally. So a friend of mine wanted to buy a car, and she actually happens to be Fijian. She's Muslim. But they thought that she was probably from Mexico, and instead of leading her to the new cars, which she asked for, they led her to used cars because they said, you can't afford one of the new cars. So that would be an example of institutional racism. But we also know that there's racism structurally. So only 2% of FHA loans during a long time of in our history, I'm forgetting the exact dates right now, only 2% were given to black families. So that is an example of structural racism keeping black families from being able to develop family wealth. So that's just one of about a billion examples of structural racism. So we try to help people understand that, and that really we live, as Isabel Wilkerson talks about, in a caste system. And of course, the problem is we think we don't, right? We assume that we don't. But her definition of caste is the granting or withholding of respect, status, honor, attention, privileges, resources, benefit of the doubt, and human kindness to someone on the basis of their perceived rank or standing in the hierarchy. So I think what's become more and more clear to me over time is that we do, in fact, live in a caste system. And part of the history of that, of course, and this is especially, you know, painful for Christian congregations when we talk about this, is to talk about the doctrines of discovery, which, if you haven't done a lot of reading about that, is really worth doing some reading. So in 1452, Pope Nicholas V gave to a Christian king and queen in Spain, and in part of Spain, divine sanction to engage in warfare with the Moors, who had another section of Spain under their authority, in which Jews and Muslims and Christians actually lived together quite peaceably. Not perfectly, but very peaceably. And so this is what Pope Nicholas wrote in part of this doctrine of discovery. "We grant you by these present documents with our apostolic authority full and free permission to invade, search out, capture, and subjugate the Saracens," and that's their name for the Muslims, "and pagans, and any other unbelievers and enemies of Christ, wherever they may be, as well as their kingdoms, duchies, counties, principalities, and other property, and to reduce their persons to perpetual servitude." So what we see here is divine sanction for war, to steal people's land, to kill people if you need to, and to reduce people into slavery. And that was the first of what are now called the doctrines of discovery. By no means were they the last. These documents still continue today in a fairly recent Supreme Court ruling to be considered precedent at the Supreme Court. So it's amazing how these documents continue. And so what we saw in our Jewish neighbors, of course, was the first sort of what would be called today critical race theory, that the Egyptian system claimed divine sanction, divine blessing for the enslavement of people, and built it into that very system. And of course, the United States, we have some very beautiful words in our Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But we know that these beautiful words were limited by the understanding of who a person was, and that men did not include women at the time, did not include people of color, did not include our indigenous sisters and brothers, did not include our African-American and black neighbors. And so it is spiritually toxic, of course, for us to uphold these kinds of words and not to live them out. And so I think it's important for us to recognize that even with these beautiful words, as narrowly defined as they were, that we do in fact live in a caste system. And so therefore, what I do talk to Christian congregations about specifically is to remember that there are three core teachings in the Abrahamic tradition. And not one of them actually has to do with Jesus. Jesus actually believes in these, right? And so the first one is to love God more than our tribe and tradition, to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, and then the third, to steward a thriving ecosystem and an equitable economy. And that we are at our best as human beings when we try to live these out, even though we do so always imperfectly. And so the kind of vision that I think that I want to resonate with is not a pyramid with Pharaoh on top and God blessing injustices and slavery all around, but rather more of a circular and open circular community in which everyone is welcome. And so as we think about this situation in which we have a caste system where we've been swimming in it, in this soup of dehumanization of each other for 500 years, how do we begin to help? Like, how do we begin to make a difference? And this is a picture from 2018 in which atheists and agnostics, Jewish folk, Christian folk, there's Unitarians, there's Buddhists, there's all kinds of folk, about every kind of cultural diversity you could imagine is standing up there, you know, on the streets of the federal courthouse, trying to encourage the Ninth District Court of Appeals to push back on and to say no to the terrible Muslim ban. And, you know, there was all kinds of effort that went into this. There were emails that went out. Someone came with a sound system. Someone printed up the signs and other kinds of things. Communities supported leaders to be able to come and attend this. As a part of their work. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful energy happening here. But the core to it is that all those folk were standing behind American Muslims who were speaking. Everybody created space for those voices. And so just think about all of the effort that went into that day. And so as we think about allyship and how we can stand behind, you know, folk, there's all kinds of names. There's ally, there's authentic ally, there's mutual partners, there's accomplice, there's accompaniment, there's solidarity, there's the practice of authentic allyship. And all of them are slightly problematic, in part because when people from the dominant culture try to stand behind people who need someone to stand behind them, who are being oppressed at the moment, that often people from the dominant culture come in and try to take over. And so there's always a constant churn of what we should call it to try to avoid this sort of dominant culture takeover of the leadership of people of color and people of different minorities. And so that's why we have to have a course. Because a lot of times people want to be helpful, but don't recognize actually all of the things that are, don't actually recognize the leadership of the different communities that are striving for their own and other people's civil rights. So there's some things that allyship isn't, right? And I want to preface this by saying I have made all of these mistakes. So I'm not accusing anybody else of mistakes I haven't seen in myself. First of all, active allyship is not self-claimed. So put the safety pin away. Another community will determine whether or not you are acting as an ally. That's something that they confer on us. That's something that they confer, or that we can confer on each other. It's not something we confer on ourselves. Secondly, it's not a search for purity. It is not a way to deal with guilt or internalized shame. It is not about maintaining or increasing your status. And it's not an insulation from the benefits of one's own privilege. The reality is we do live in a caste system, and that caste system has conferred on me for nothing of my own effort or skills, all kinds of benefits. Those are still there, whether or not I'm an ally or not. And so I think the other part that we do with allyship sometimes is we make it a bit too complicated. So the first kind of allyship that's really important is that you have an in-group. You probably have several. And there are people that are in other in-groups. And you sort of work in a way in the world in which you begin to relate to multiple groups. And particularly when you relate, we relate to a group that is currently under some kind of oppression from the dominant culture, we can kind of do some really powerful allyship just by relating to both. And that's a really powerful way to do allyship. You don't have to be in front of a microphone to be an ally. You just participate with multiple groups, right? And you can kind of draw them together over time. You can also create space within your in-group to persons of another in-group so that they can, let me get this together here again, so that they can have space within your group. Now, there's two things about this. One of which is you got to make sure that you're doing some prep work with your in-group. And number two, you got to make sure that it's a safe environment, you know, for this person. But you also have to make sure that that person has some practice at working with different in-groups and has the kind of support to be able to handle some of the negativity that they're probably going to face. That's a lot of the work I did with Neighbors in Faith. As I go into a congregation, a community of wisdom, I would do some presentation, and then a few weeks later would bring in an American Muslim who was trained to be able to handle that situation and had the support to do it. So you can create space within your own in-group. You can also stand up in public. So when a community is under some kind of oppression or pressure, you can stand behind them. You can gather other people to stand behind them, and you can help put the microphone in front of them so that they can be heard. And this is one of the most powerful things we can do for each other when the time is right, when it's necessary. But we can also do something else, and that is to work for the common good together. And so it's very typical of Christian congregations, particularly white ones, to think that they can sit around in some committee room and decide how to fix some problem without the people in the room who are most impacted by that problem. And so one of the beautiful things we can do is to create space where we can listen to people most impacted and begin to work together for the common good. Because when communities see the diverse groups of folk are working together and benefiting the community, a lot of the dehumanization and stigmatization that happens with people begins to go away. It begins to get, oh, well, hey, wait a minute, you know. And so it's really important for us to find diverse groups of people to work together for the common good, because then all kinds of great things happen. So when we teach about authentic allyship, of course, we want to be clear about what we mean by love. That love is not so much our feelings about other people or whether we yell at the TV. Love is willingness to take a risk so that oneself, one's neighbors, one's neighborhoods can experience greater shalom, peace, salam, shanti, etc. So it's not just about feelings. And it's about both leadership and followership. So within my own community, Lutheran and Episcopal, you know, primarily, I'm exercising leadership. And I have people all the time, you know, come up to me and say, hey, what about this? Hey, what about that? I don't quite agree with you here. You know, I want to help, but I don't know how. So I can engage in leadership within that, within my own in-groups. But when it comes time to stand with American Muslims, for instance, I am no longer the leader. I am there, and this is, of course, not great English, but I'm engaged in followership, not just leadership. So I am actively taking the lead of those most impacted by the caste system and then offering the gifts and skills and abilities that I have. Always remembering that the most important thing, of course, is their leadership. And part of this is really important is to understand power differently, how we understand our own power in this kind of situation. And so I like to talk about three kinds of power. And the first is power over others. And I think we've all been familiar with that, and that's a big part of American culture. It's certainly where we think that we're more human when we have more power than others. And then there's the third one, of course, which is power with others. And I think that's the beautiful vision of that circle of Martin Luther King Jr.'s beloved community, is that we're most fully human when we have power with each other. But there are a few moments in life when we need to have power for others. And allies sometimes can exercise power for others to speak when another group is being oppressed and cannot be heard. But here's the core thing about this, is that that usually can only happen for a moment. Because if we don't move very quickly to create space for that community to speak for itself, we continue to perpetuate a kind of dependency, and we actually perpetuate the unjust system itself. And so when we talk about allyship, I really try to emphasize that I am not an ally. I practice authentic allyship, true to myself, true to the community that I'm standing with, but it's not my identity, you know, because if it's my identity, what happens if the unjust system changes and all of a sudden I'm not needed? Well, then I might kind of pull my punches. I might act in a way that perpetuates the system. And so I want to make sure that my identity is that I'm a human being, not that I'm an ally. So whenever anybody calls me an ally, I say, no, I'm not. I'm a human being. But I practice allyship. So a couple core concepts, and I'll just run through these super fast. One is risking self and status to dismantle systems of oppression. We got to practice self-care in the midst of this. It's a lifelong process of reforming our heart, attitudes, and actions. We don't ever get it right. We have to consistently investigate our own motivations, which is where most of those allyship is not things came from, me doing that. We have to assess the effectiveness of our words and attitudes and actions and educate ourselves about what impacts marginalized communities and effective responses to them. And so just to conclude here for a moment, I think Lila Watson, an Aboriginal leader, said it beautifully. If you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. So we do need to move beyond our warm feelings and our anger on behalf of people, move into relationship with them, and learn very carefully how to stand behind them, how to support their work for justice, for peace, for their human and civil rights, and to exhibit leadership within our own communities, within our own in-groups, but to accept the leadership of people who are most impacted so that we can actually contribute to the healing of our society by creating space for their voices and supporting them by creating a more just world for all of us. So that's my little intro to allyship, and I really appreciate you listening.